Hey, welcome in. We got a lot to get to today on our show. Change in head coaches for Arkansas Gymnastics. We're going to talk Razorback football. That was the original plan today. Tom Murphy is in studio with me. It just so happens that Tom is both our football and our gymnastics beat reporter. We'll get to that here in just a minute. I want to tell you that when it comes to your game day, you want the best in your lineup, and that includes your eggs. Eggland's Best delivers more than nutrition you need with six times more vitamin D and 25% less saturated fat than ordinary eggs. You can score now with Eggland's Best. Better taste, better nutrition, better eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com. For more information. Also brought to you by Bentonville Glass. They've been serving their community since 1971. They're committed, professional, and versatile. If you are looking for a quality leader in Northwest Arkansas or looking for skilled craftsmanship, look no further than Bentonville Glass for all your glass market needs with the highest quality products. You can come by and see them now at 507 South Main in Bentonville or online at BentonvilleGlass.com. Appreciate you being with us wherever you found us today. Maybe it's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, one of our social media channels. We post this on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for being here. Hope that you'll subscribe to our channel while you're here. So the big story today is gymnastics. Jordan Weber, who was hired here 7 years ago, former gold medalist, she's resigning as Arkansas's head coach. She's going to be replaced by Chris Brooks, who has been her assistant coach and is also her husband. And, you know, we're going to find out a little bit more this afternoon as we record this. It is before they have had their press conference to talk about this. There's a press conference scheduled for this afternoon in Fayetteville. Tom, I know that she's at the age where she's having kids, and that can be just from my own personal experience, people I know, you get to that age, and that influences how you think about your professional career. We'll see if she says that has a bearing on why she's making this decision. But that was my first thought when I read this news that she had resigned as the head coach.
Yeah, when you start having family, it shapes your landscape of your life. And we don't know for certain that is, but her statement in the release did indicate focusing on family. Mm. And, you know, the hours required to do all the recruiting and all the coaching you have to do is certainly a consideration on all this. But just from the flow of things that they're going to be at the press conference together, that would be my sense, that they had Gigi last June. She came to some meets. Jordan wants maybe to focus on more children. We don't know.
Yeah.
So it makes sense to me that that's going to be something she's going to spend her time doing, because when you're committed to family, I very much honor that.
When you're a young mother, I mean, you see this a lot of times, and sometimes it's out of necessity. Sometimes it's you got to figure out how you're going to pay for daycare. I don't think that's an issue when you've got a couple of Division I head coaches that are working. But, it's when you're a young mother, a lot of times you see this happen. You know, you've only got those years for so long. Again, maybe that's what she means by this focus on the family. I suspect that probably is. And the fact that they're staying here in Fayetteville. Yeah. You know, it's not like she is leaving here and taking another job. She's leaving here and they're kind of staying in the same roles. It's just now the husband moves into that head coaching gauntlet, if you will.
Yeah, and my thought would be that Jordan Weber would be around the program quite a lot with the baby, and just as the baby was a lot this year.
Could still possibly contribute, like as a volunteer, I'm sure.
Very well could do that, but you do wonder. So Jocelyn Robinson's transfer news was yesterday, mm-hmm. and then this today. Maybe Jocelyn Robinson had a head up. I don't know.
I think that wouldn't surprise me. And that was I wanted to make that point too, is that, you know, Jocelyn Robinson, for those who don't know, I mean, she is a former, U.S. Olympic team
gymnast. Yeah, she was
gymnast. Mm-hmm. Like, probably the best gymnastics recruit they've ever had in here would be my take on this, or one of the best. And so she announced yesterday that she was going to go into the transfer portal. I think everybody's antenna went up at that point. It's like, what's going on that's causing them to lose not just, like, a really good gymnast, but, like, maybe the best they've ever recruited in here. And so I think that, you know, that's probably correct. I think that, this did not scream of a press release and a plan today that said, we're throwing this thing together. that there has been some, you know, some talk, some dialogue behind the scenes. And, you know, I'm sure that the athletes probably were informed within the last day or so, or got, you know, they probably got a sense that this was coming.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. And by the way, shout out to Christina Long, who is also a gymnastics reporter for us, who gave me the heads up as I was driving into this very studio to do this show that it was going down. So I would say this about Jocelyn Robertson, probably the most heralded recruit, but the best gymnast that they've had here is Catherine Grable, a two-time champion.
National champion.
I think it was in 2014 she did that. But that team was pretty loaded. Had Jamie Pisani as well and did very well under Mark Cook and Renee Cook at the time. So it was a big loss. But I think the continuity they'll enjoy. I'm sure I would think Kyla Ross would stay on staff and Chris Brooks will kind of maintain where they were from a recruiting standpoint.
It's interesting to me that this is the sixth program in the last 3 years that's had a new head coach at Arkansas. And three of them, when you count gymnastics, have been internal promotions. The three that were not were the three most high-profile sports, arguably, with women's basketball, men's basketball, and football. But I don't know if this is a sign of good things to come for Chris Brooks or not. Chris Johnson got promoted to be the women's track and field coach when Lance Harder retired. He won two national championships his first year. Doug Case got promoted to be the men's track and field coach when Chris Bucknum retired back in the fall. And Doug just won a national championship in the indoor season his first year. They look like they got a pretty good team outdoors as well. Maybe that's good luck for Chris Brooks. I don't know. But I guess all of that is to say that these promotions have seemed to work so far for the, you know, the programs that have for Juracek in the programs where he's elected to go in that direction.
That's a good point. And who knows how that will play out. But it's also like the most seamless, the easiest type transition to make, especially when he comes from the same household as Jordan Weaver.
So, well, and I think he's been very influential to whatever measure of success they've had with Weaver as their head coach because he's been their number one assistant.
Yep, that's right. Two-time national champion himself at Oklahoma. So, by the way, I'm just going to throw this funny factoid in there. I got it off Wikipedia, so, you know, beware the source. But I was looking up the Fierce Five and the origins for the name, and apparently, you know, they were called the Fab Five by U.S. media originally, I guess the summer of 2012 or the spring when they were coming together.
Probably couldn't use that name because of Michigan.
Well, apparently, was it Jalen Rose was a member of the Michigan team, said something about they were the Fab Five. And so the gymnasts themselves were looking for a different name. And according to this story, Jordan Weaver and Michaela Maroney were on a bus looking at their phones for names to replace Fab. And either had Feisty or Fierce as the choice and wound up on Fierce Five. And that's what they were dubbed, and that's what you will see presented for their name.
All right, so you can read more about gymnastics at WholeHogSports.com. Of course, we're going to have more on this story this afternoon after the press conference. But Jordan Weaver is no longer the head coach of the Arkansas gymnastics program. Chris Brooks is in. Big news today in the gymnastics world. Anytime that there's news involving Jordan Weaver, we have found that it is big news because of the profile that she's had from her days as an Olympian. Razorback baseball is scheduled to play tonight against Northwestern State at Baum Walker Stadium. It's rainy outside. It's storming. We'll see if this game gets played. I'm not 100% sure that it's going to. This is supposed to clear out at some point tonight. It's just a matter of how long do these teams want to stay out there and get a Tuesday night game in. We'll see. We'll see about this. But Arkansas and Northwestern State scheduled to play at 6. I interviewed Chris Bertrand, who is the head coach at Northwestern State. We've got a story on our site at WholeHogSports.com from that. You can read that right now if you want. Arkansas and Northwestern State scheduled to play a two-game series here in Fayetteville. Scheduled to play again tomorrow at 3 o'clock. One thing I didn't notice when Bubba was in here with me yesterday is, and I didn't realize this until I talked to their coach about an hour after we finished recording, was that they don't play a weekend series this week. And so they don't have the same kind of – they don't have the same turnaround that Arkansas has after that Wednesday game. they can get creative with their pitching because they are going to have a longer rest time. They don't play another game until Tuesday of next week is when they play again. And so that's going to be kind of interesting. I did ask their coach. I said, does this make you think about using any of your weekend starters in like a relief role, a bullpen role, and then they would have, you know, extra time to get ready for their next start? And he said, absolutely not. So don't think that we're going to see them do that, but I think they can get – probably I think what he's talking about whenever he says they can get – I don't know if creative was his word, but that was the gist of what he told me. It probably comes from a bullpen perspective where it's – you can stretch some of these relievers out, and I think tonight is a perfect example. They're going to start a pitcher, Carter White, a left-hander, who he started the first 5 weeks of the season for them, but he has not started since then. He's been a reliever, but they're going to put him back into a starter role and probably stretch him out, you know, instead of throwing him 20 times a weekend, or 2 times a weekend, 20 to 30 pitches. Maybe they can stretch him out and get a little bit more length out of him. Tonight, Arkansas is going to start Tate McGuire, which is what we expected.
Yeah, when you have a double weekend series, all kind of pitching plans can be on the table.
A double midweek.
That's what I meant, double midweek. And when I texted you last night, because I was looking up some stuff on Northwestern, I was like, hey, Matt, they don't play a weekend series. They can use their starters.
Mm-hmm.
And Matt's like, nah, I talked to the coach. But it's funny, how rare is it? I mean, I don't know if I've ever known a team that did not have a weekend.
It's the Southland Conference. So if you look at the Southland Conference standings right now, Northwestern State is tied for the most wins in the Southland with 16. They're 16-11. Now Southeastern and Lamar both have 16 wins too, but they're 16-8. And what happens in the Southland is that I think there's an even number of football playing teams, but one of the teams that plays football does not have a baseball team. And so there's an odd number of baseball teams. And so everybody gets one weekend off every year. Now, they can choose to play that weekend if they want to. They could schedule another non-conference series. But what a lot of them do is they take that as an opportunity to rest their guys for a weekend and then get back into it in the midweek.
I think the Big 12 has been doing that, because when we look over Big 12 schedules, yeah, they always play somebody kind of strange in the middle.
Yeah, because in the Big 12, Colorado doesn't have baseball. I think maybe Iowa State doesn't have baseball either.
They don't have gymnastics now either.
Iowa State, they cut their gymnastics team. By the way, we're going to talk Razorback tennis and what happened last week at some point this week on the podcast. I've got some stuff in the works, so just stay tuned. We're going to have that conversation on this show one day, hopefully this week, just trying to get some guests lined up to have an intelligent conversation about the cuts with Razorback tennis. Razorback football, you had the spring game over the weekend, and we'll get to the spring game, but there was also the draft that happened over the weekend. What stood out to you from the draft? I mean, I think, you know, probably did it surprise you that Julian Neal was the first one taken? Because, you know, we had talked about this last week, how Isaac Tesla was the first one taken last year by the Lions, and nobody really saw that coming. I would say kind of the same thing happened with Julian Neal. I don't know that a lot of people thought he would be the first one off the board.
Yeah, you know, if I was Brendan Sorsby, I probably would have had a bet on Mike Washington being the first Razorback taken in the draft. Okay, no, he's in rehab for that, and good for him. But
where do you think he got the money for that?
Yikes.
You know what I mean?
You know,
It's almost like it's a bad idea to give 20-year-olds an unlimited amount of money.
And I tell you, I think it's a product of 20-somethings and their need for, like, getting constant input and feedback. I don't have
stimulation.
The stimulation of doing that, like, oh, I won, I lost on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have that stimulation, but I get how they do. And, yes, I would have had Mike Washington the first pick, but I saw the clips. He was dressed very nicely. As they say, he had a nice drip, and I was so happy for him in a good setting, cool jacket. And I just really hope it works out for him. But Julian Neal, it was a bad Arkansas secondary, but he was a good cornerback, a physical cornerback who came up and tackled in a bad secondary. And the scouts know that kind of stuff. They see what his skills are. And good for Julian Neal to have a good season.
He always stood out to me.
He was a good.
Like in a positive way. I remember, and I can't remember exactly which game it was. But there was a game early in the season. I don't think it was Notre Dame. It might have been Memphis. In fact, Memphis is the game that I'm thinking it was, because it was one of those days. It felt like in my mind, this isn't going well for the Razorbacks, but this guy stands out.
Yeah.
And so I think it might have been the Memphis game where, you know, you see 2, 3, 4 plays from him, you know, in a pretty short, you know, compact time frame, and he was he stood out. I guess maybe that's the way to say it. And
he did.
Honestly, it's easy to stand out on that defense that they had last
year. Well, it was, because he stood up a lot more in coverage than the rest of their corners. And I want to say, I know Miguel Mitchell had a pick in that game, and I think Neal had an interception, because they had two in that game. But I also can't remember, was he the DB who was flagged on the offense?
I think he, should have been OPI.
Pass interference, which
I think
Tim
Kramsey
did admit to.
Yep.
He thought it was going to be offensive pass interference. But
changed the game.
It really
totally
did. It was 28
that game.
To 10.
28 to 10.
Point.
It's 28 to 17. And
but quick side note on Julian Neal, Alabama State, the first series of the year on defense Arkansas played, they went to his side.
Picked
they
on
must
him.
Have been in zone mm-hmm. or something, but they went to his side on two or three receptions on that first drive, but then he had a much better season after that.
So he went in the third round, 35th overall to the Seattle Seahawks. He was one of the first players taken in the third round. Of course, Mike Washington was the player that we all kind of thought might go first for the Razorbacks. He ends up going in the fourth round to the Raiders. Kind of looking through this some more. I know that Fernando Carmona got picked fifth round by the Tennessee Titans. Campbell did not get picked. Xavier Sorey did not get picked. Those were the others that got invited to the scouting combine. And then, of course, Talen Green got drafted in the sixth round by the Cleveland Browns. And I got to tell you, my initial reaction whenever he got drafted by the Browns was, of course he did.
Exactly.
Of course he did. Of course, the quarterback who is seen as probably the biggest project in this draft, because a lot of the scouts apparently wanted him to, or the executives, whoever, they said, hey, why don't you look at being a receiver? Why don't you look at no, I'm going to stick with being a quarterback. And that's his right. You know, that's his right. That's what, and I can totally respect that from Talen's standpoint, where this is the position where you've put all of this work into, is to being a quarterback. So I can respect that. I don't think it's going to work out for him long term, because I don't think he's going to – I just don't see him lasting as a quarterback long term in the NFL. But, of course, the Browns, who are notorious for their poor drafting and procurement of quarterbacks – take Talen Green. Like, it almost had, you almost felt like going into it, it's going to be a team like the Browns, like the Jets, you know, one of these teams that just can never seem to figure out their quarterback position. And then you got the Browns here. They drafted two quarterbacks last year. They drafted Dillon Gabriel and Shedeur Sanders last year, and now they're drafting Talen Green. It doesn't set up very well for him, I don't think, to be in Cleveland for very long.
I'm not prepared to have the hot take you are that he's not going to make it at quarterback in the NFL.
I'm not saying so, – well, no, I am saying that.
So, but I will say that when that happened, we were sitting in the press box at the Red-White game, and I said, oh, my gosh, of all the teams to take him. And I looked up their roster really fast and talked to Christina. I think there were already three quarterbacks on their roster. I mm-hmm. think they still have Dillon Gabriel. They still have Shedeur Sanders. And Deshaun Watson is coming back. And at this time last year, I think they had Joe Flacco and maybe one other quarterback. They totally bungled their QB situation last year.
But they've been doing this for 25 years.
They have, and I really feel for Talen that it is the Browns, because I don't know how you go in there and navigate through that mess, because there's going to be egos and Shadur's involved, and there's always something strange going on with Shedeur involved.
There's always something weird going on with the Browns. Now, I will say, with the Browns, their offensive coordinator or their head coach – their new head coach is Todd Monken, who previously was the OC with the Ravens. And you've got that connection where you had Lamar Jackson played for Petrino, of course, Talen, when Petrino was the coordinator and then the interim head coach here, he drew a lot of comparisons between Talen and Lamar Jackson. Mm-hmm. So you do have that connection. But again, I don't know where he fits in that quarterback room in Cleveland. I just don't think it's a good situation for him. I think if he was going to be successful in the NFL, and I think this is a long shot too, but if he was going to be successful in the NFL, I think his better route would have been to go into like a very established franchise.
Denver's the first program I just thought of. Denver.
That's not a bad one. I mean, you got Sean Payton as the head coach there. You got Bo Nix as an established quarterback.
And you know you're going to be on the bench learning from a guy who's an established starter.
Where you can, you can sit in an environment that's going to help you grow, and then maybe in 3 or 4 years, it's your time to go. Kind of like what happened with Tony Romo and Bill Parcells, and Sean Payton was the offensive coordinator with the Cowboys at that time. Something like that. I don't know. I think maybe the best thing that could happen for Talen, and I don't know how all this works, but I think that in the NFL, once you get past a certain round, you're not guaranteed a roster spot. Help me if I'm wrong. I don't know this because, you know, I don't cover that. But I think maybe the best thing that could happen for him is that he gets cut in Cleveland and ends up with a different franchise where he can go sit in that type of environment and learn and grow more as a quarterback. Because based on what we saw last year, him getting benched for a freshman in the SEC tells me that he's not anywhere near ready to be playing in the NFL at that position.
I just wish him the best because I do think he's a very nice, very good kid.
Great guy. I've enjoyed the interactions that I've had with him. But this is about evaluating. You know, I mean, the NFL, it's cutthroat. There's a lot of nice guys who get cut in the NFL. You know, it's very, you know, it's very merit-based, meritocracy. It is, and, you know, you gotta be, I think now just about more than ever, you got to really be ready to go as a quarterback because of all of the quarterback prospects that there seem to be every single year. And it seems like, you know, like next year with Arch Manning, I don't know who else is in that draft off the top of my head. But I know that this year there was talk about it's not the most talented quarterback class. Typically when that's the case, the next cycle of quarterbacks is a lot more talented class.
Yeah. Well, we have a limited amount of time now to talk about the red-white game.
All right. We almost filibustered our way out of talking about the red-white game. What do you make of it? I mean, what was the final score? 14-13? Yeah. I think there was a defensive touchdown in there too. From all indications, and I'll be honest, I didn't watch it. I was covering baseball, and, of course, you know, they decided not to televise this year. From all indications, the offense didn't look real good. The quarterbacks had a pretty struggle day.
Well, I'm not looking at the stats right now, but I can be. I think KJ was 9 of 13, which is not bad. And AJ
but how
Hill,
much of that was down the field passing and how much of it was the high percentage throws that are at or just beyond the line of
scrimmage?
There
was a 65-yarder to C.J. Brown for a touchdown in there, and there were some check downs. They didn't do a whole ton of stuff over the middle, and one of them was the pick six that Hill threw. But he was 9 of 17, but there were four passes dropped on his side of the ball and three by Chris Marshall. So my overall take was this. I thought the operation of things, the plays getting to the quarterbacks getting to the line, they huddled. Silverfield called it a muddle huddle because they did not want to show their signals from the sideline that anybody could record and use.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that they used a system that they will not be using during the games and that yet they didn't have any really huge alignment mess ups. I think they had two false starts. And I know there were some holdings that probably weren't called or that weren't called, but otherwise it was relatively clean and I thought the operation was good. So from that standpoint, I thought it came across fairly well. They do have work to do at their timing in the downfield passing game. The cornerbacks were there on several of them. I know Roland wanted a deep ball, and Marshall was right there in position. And I want to say either Shelton Lewis or DJ Harrison was in position on another deep ball. So that was good. I think they're going to be good at running back. Braylon Russell broke tackles on 2-3 of his runs, maybe four, and multiple tackles on a couple of those. And Cam Settles looked really good. So I think they're going to have three. And I'm thankful that they didn't use Sutton Smith very much. And they avoided what I think was any major injuries in this game, which is the number one deal. Because I know I've been doing some little stuff around the conference. Georgia suffered a huge loss at either edge rusher or linebacker. And A&M had a huge injury in their spring game. So,
and it's because both were on TV, right?
Those were the only
those
two.
Those were the only
they?
Two on
oh,
TV.
Oh, my gosh.
But both. I laughed whenever you talked about this muddle huddle. You know, the game's not on TV. How many people were there? 4,000?
No,
5,000?
There was more than that.
It looked really – because they didn't have anybody in the West stands, right?
If there were, everybody they were tucked up under.
But it looked like pretty much everybody who was in attendance were over on the east side, right?
Mostly in the east, some under the shade. I think there were some in the luxury boxes, and there were certainly some on the north and south and some of the levels that you really can't look in there and see too great.
Okay.
So it's all guesswork.
Okay, because based on the picture that I saw of the east stands, it didn't look like there were a whole lot of people there.
I would have guessed east stands at maybe 5,000 to 6,000.
Okay, but that's where I laugh about the muddle huddle thing. It's like there's not a whole lot of people in the stadium. and the game's not televised, and yet paranoia of football coaches is undefeated.
You brought up what's his name, Connor Stallions, last week.
Connor
you
Stallions.
Brought him up.
Yeah,
there could have been
there?
A.
There
could
have
been. There, no, I didn't see him, but there could have been him or somebody like him in the stands if they had been signaling, and it could have mm-hmm. gotten out. So they decided to, you know, use caution, the wisdom of not showing their signals, and probably a smart move.
It's paranoia. That's what it is. It is. Football coaches have paranoia. They do. They always have. They always will. If you were going to go spy, like I don't want to get more into the spring game for a second, but if you were going to go spy on a team, like would you dress in like a neutral gear, or would you go like to the team shop and you know buy a Razorback visor, you know buy like a Razorback tennis shirt that's on sale, you know go wear something like that.
Just as making online bets on my phone is foreign to me, so is spying on a team's spring football game. I don't know what I would wear. I probably would wear what I have on and let it roll. But
okay.
I'm not going to spy on people, man.
All right. That's fair enough. Hey, you mentioned a 65-yard touchdown pass to C.J. Brown. Was it a deep pass, or was it something that was at the line and
it was a
gone?
Deep, according to C.J., it was a crossing route. It was a deep play. And I'm guessing they were in zone, or there would have been somebody closer because
yeah.
he was very open.
Yeah.
But he did a great job skirting the sideline. And there was a couple of defenders who like maybe had angles.
Mm-hmm.
But he showed good speed down the left sideline. I think somebody dove for him. Maybe Tay Lockett dove for him right at the end. But he caught it right around the 40, and so he did 40 yards or so down the sideline. It was a very good play. But I just thought there were a few creases in the run game. The O-line held up okay, but we have to remember they weren't doing any super exotic blitzing. And
they were split, right? It was
they
not
were split
like,
up.
The first team aligned was not playing all five together.
Exactly. So you got that to consider, communication aspect. Quincy Rose was in there several times. They whistled some stuff dead, sack, and then they let some stuff go on when they were there too. Same with Steven Soles. He had two, what I would say, official sacks. And then, you know, Jamonte Waller, I wrote about this, the Jacks, Waller, Soles, and Charlie Collins all had flash plays for them. So that bodes well for what their edge work could do. And I think there's a little bit of depth at linebacker, too. But Bradley Shaw didn't, you know, really have a great game. I think he had two tackles. Wyatt Simmons had two. They were on the same team. But Ben Bogle had 10 tackles. He was really all over the place for the whatever team he was on.
I really feel like you can't take a whole lot away from these games when you don't have ones-on-ones, twos-on-twos. Like I think that's when you get the best feel for – what a team really looks like. Like even in scrimmages where you got ones on twos or in twos on ones the other way, I feel like it's very lopsided and not real easy to figure out exactly what you're watching, especially now. And this is how I felt back when I was doing a lot of football coverage 10 years ago, back when you could build depth. Now you can't really build depth so much because of the the financial component that's there.
Yeah.
And you can pay for the frontline players, but where you really see the separation between teams is the teams that can pay for the backups and the teams that can't. And I feel like Arkansas is one of those teams that really can't relative to the teams that are winning the most in college football.
Correct.
And so I don't know. It's hard to – I don't know. I guess it's hard to take a whole lot away from this, although I will say one thought I had is when you've got – basically a 14-6 or 13-7, whatever the score was, if you take away the defensive touchdown, you know, like two scores to one, basically two touchdowns to one. You combine that with the reports a couple, 3 weeks ago that they had a full scrimmage where there were no touchdowns scored, and the concerns that I think are well-founded going into this spring about what they did and did not do from a talent acquisition perspective on offense, especially at quarterback, I think you've got to have some real concerns about what the offense is going to look like when they're playing the likes of Georgia and Utah and these teams that traditionally can play really sound defense when the season gets here.
Yeah, you gave me a lot of avenues to explore right there.
I try to do my best.
And I will try to say this. I don't think you can take a whole lot from the game, because it was, as Silverfield pointed out, Quincy Rhodes could have been going up against the third team tackle, and he should win that rep. But what they did find out is who knew the playbook, who knew the adjustments, what guys' pass rushing moves looked like, what guys' pass blocking stood up to. So you individually, guys' technique, you can take a lot from it. But what they did against that guy, maybe you can't so much. You're right. They cannot afford a ton of talent behind their top-end guys. And I, as you do, have questions about their overall talent on offense next year. They're going to have to be a very good third down conversion team. They're going to have to play better defense to give them a chance if the quarterbacks are just, you know, okay.
Win the turnover margin.
All that kind of stuff.
Not commit penalties. It's like one of those teams where it's kind of like a small ball baseball team.
That's what they're going to have to do.
You can't beat yourself, and you kind of got to dink and dime against the other team.
I think they understand what they are, and I think they understand that winning the turnover battle is massive for them. Playing smart, playing complimentary, and like believing in each other, because that's one thing you can never measure is how much the belief is in place to bounce back from bad plays and all that kind of stuff.
So the spring is over. Now we get into this portion of the football calendar where you start getting the comparisons between the teams. Like SEC Football Media Days is coming up in a couple, 3 months down in Tampa, you know, and you're going to get the preseason poll that says this team's number one and this team's number 16. I'm going to have a hard time believing, Tom, that Arkansas is not going to be 15-16 in that poll.
I think we talked about that on a previous podcast. The only team you could might or teams you could might put below them are Kentucky and Mississippi State, maybe. Yep. And that's why games like South Carolina loom very large. You have to win those kind of games if you're going to climb up in the standings. And you're right. A lot of comparisons are going to start being made. And every other team acquired great talent and did, you know, take LSU, for example. They spent a ton of money on their coach and players, and they will be more highly regarded than a lot of other teams.
Doesn't mean they're going to win.
Nope.
I mean, you can pay a ton. Look at LSU baseball this year. They probably they outspent a lot of teams, I'm sure. But I think that when you are the team that can afford the coaches and the players, you are going to put yourself in a position to win much more often than not. Because I don't think it's ever about the talent when you have spent that kind of money. It's all about how do they get along in the locker room. Yeah. And sometimes you get these situations where you can have a team full of really talented players and they don't like each other and they're not going to play hard for each other. And I think that's what happens more often than not when you have these teams that, you know, fall flat on their face and it's a thud. So, you know, maybe Arkansas can punch above their weight a little bit, but it feels to me coming out of the spring a lot like it's felt to me coming out of a lot of the past, you know, past 10 springs or so, where a lot of those seasons just did not go very well.
I do not disagree with your points. And I think we're in an era of college football right now where the name on the back of the jersey and what their brand is going to look like and how much money they will make doing this, that, or the other is maybe not so much with the player, but their people, their family sometimes, their advisors and all those, their reps. It's the money-making aspect to it. So sometimes the name on the back gets a little bit more heavy than the name on the front. And when you can build a team where the name on the front is very important to your entire locker room, and from all we hear from Ryan Silverfield, that's his MO, then the better off you can be, because you're right. Very talented and very highly paid rosters have fallen apart.
You can read Tom at WholeHogSports.com. He's going to have some football follow-up stories and revisiting some spring football questions this week on our website. Again, our thanks to Bentonville Glass and Eglin's Best for sponsoring our show, and we hope that you will subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or one of our social media channels. Be back with another show tomorrow. Hope to see you then or at our website, WholeHogSports.com.